and she's herself. It is warm in here.
I'll turn it off just now.
Yeah.
Should I crack the door open?
I'm okay. I think there's a mixture of requirements in here, so I'm feeling quite nervous because I'm doing this talk without notes, and I've never done that in my life before. But given that I've never stopped talking since I was 3 years old, I should hopefully not have a problem filling the next space and time, whether it's with stuff that's useful or makes sense. Let you be the judge. Okay, so we're beginning. I'll start with just so some people might know me, some people might not. My name's Aria Sheila. I've been around this movement for probably about 20 years now, actually, and I've been ordained for coming up to 6 years. And when we decided that we'd like to do this season of Saturday mornings around the theme of ethics, I offered to kind of introduce the series partly because my name and my kind of practice is very strongly around ethics. My name means she who has a noble character or conduct, and when you're given your order name, it's given to you by your preceptor, someone who knows and loves you very well and wants to give you a name that both imbues who they think you are and what they believe you can turn into as well. And of course, what one does often with those sort of names is sometimes focus on that, oh, they've given me this name because I need to be much better at this. Or if you're feeling positive, they give me this name because I'm already doing this all right. And it's obviously an important area. So I think both of those things in equal measure at different times of the day. But I really like having that name, and I think it's true that for me, my conscience and my ethical behaviour is something that motivates me to throughout my life, throughout my day-to-day, minute-by-minute practice. And I didn't really realise that until I was I didn't realise that that's what I was doing until that was kind of spelled out a bit. But I think it's a really useful lesson. And so I want to try and cover a few areas this week to sort of give you a flavour of what will unfold over the next 3 months. And when I was meditating before, a sort of title or sort of like kind of way of thinking about ethics, particularly from a Buddhist perspective, came to mind. So I'll say that first. So I thought of this like phrase, the only judge is your own human heart. And I think that's where Buddhist ethics kind of, that's the focus of Buddhist ethics. And I'll say a little bit more about that later. So I want to talk generally about ethics and their sort of place in society and how and where they manifest. I want to talk a little bit about, we kind of touched on it before when we were briefly talking about the refugee crisis across the world. And I feel that if you peel back the kind of societal norms or rules or guidance that we try and live by, that behind all of our thoughts and actions are two extremes of fear and compassion, both of which are kind of quite natural phenomenon in the human mind and psyche, and we're wrestling with those two things all the time. And the more aware we are of that, I think the easier we can be with ourselves, and the better we can raise our understanding of how we're behaving and how others behave if we think about life and living our lives through the spheres of fear and compassion and where we are on that continuum. And then I want to talk a little bit about why bother being ethical, what's the point, and then focus a bit more on what's the difference between Buddhist ethics and ethics generally. And that's where we can talk a little bit about how in Buddhist ethics, you're your own judge. Nobody else is judging you. And the importance of confession practice in that. And then I'll talk about the 10 precepts, which are going to be the pillars of this 3 months. So I'll briefly run through those if I haven't run out of time with the more general stuff. So So just to like, I think it's very important to, talking about ethics generally, to remember that human beings have been trying to be ethical and are naturally have a natural ethical bent throughout time. All religions have some kind of ethical basis in them, and many of them have lists of commandments or rules or guidance. And philosophers have wrestled with how to live an ethical life throughout millennia. I went to see a very heavy play last night called Oresteia, which I didn't really understand, but 3.5 hours of it, and after a heavy week at work, was pretty ongoing. But it's beginning to sort of unpack as the hours pass beyond it. And you know, the Greeks were immensely clever at putting stories together that make you then reflect on the moral ambiguities of being a human being and what's right and what's wrong. And all I can say is that there was a point in the play where they were treating the audience as the jury and the way they the portrayal of this, and I was screaming innocent in my head at the final moments of the play where something was about to happen, you know. So it was very, so whatever was going on and how much I did or didn't understand it, there was that compendium, that sort of pendulum of right and wrong, good and bad, guilty, innocent, you know, that is what is in our own minds and in society's minds all the time. So of course the big religions have developed ethical guidelines to help people live a better life. And I do think that being ethical is a natural phenomenon. I do think that human beings, generally speaking, are wired to be ethical. And but of course we're also wired to be fearful. We're wired to survive. And sometimes those two things conflict. And we live in very fast-paced and modern and busy, stressful lives, many of us. And I think that heightens our sense of fear, very physiologically. And I think that is something that I've realised over the years, that's what's happening inside my body, is that while I might want to have a compassionate response, I'm so adrenalised by modern existence and the way I'm living my life that when you think about what adrenaline was for, as sort of like, you know, when human beings were running around the forests of the wild planet, it was to keep you safe from harm, from being eaten. It would heighten your senses to be alert to the dangers around the corner. And of course, I think one of the dilemmas of being a Western human living in a quite complicated society with a lot to do all the time is that adrenaline is pumping in us a little bit more strongly than it needs to, actually, because, you know, sitting here in our cosy lives in Croydon, we really don't have much to be afraid of other than the inevitable that it's all going to end, and we don't need to be afraid of that. But I do think that colours how our response is, and sometimes it masks our ability to be as compassionate as we want to be. So if you take what we're witnessing now across the world with the refugees pouring into Europe in such desperate plight, there is a mixture of fear of people, and I own some of that, of thinking, oh my word, what's going to happen? I can't cope with this. I just want to look the other way. And compassion of, come on, of course we can help. You know, I've got a spare bedroom. Why haven't I got some refugees living in there? I mean, it's crazy that that's going on. And it's even interesting. I was listening to the Today programme this morning, and one of the reporters was following the Hungarian exodus from Budapest to Austria. Literally people walking 100 miles along the road until they decided to help them by putting some buses on. And it's when it gets right down to, like, you know, him talking about an individual woman and her children and how, and you know, and again about the child on the beach, it's like when it's really brought into a real individual, that's when often that fear of that horrified anxiety of the big picture kind of peels away, and we just, our own human heart can't do anything but open to that. And of course, that's when, you know, and it's really interesting listening to this guy talking about how these people are walking down this road, getting Hungarian people coming along and feeding them and giving them, you know, sustenance, and other people driving past them and shouting abuse at them. And that's fear and compassion happening in the same place. And it's like, and to use a Buddhist expression, that's skillful and unskillful behaviour. But it's really important, I think, not to see the people that are sharing the abuse as bad. They're just terrified. And that fear comes from somewhere. It comes from somewhere. And it's, you know, it's the same in this country. There's this, you know, awful kind of political mishmash going on with language, calling people migrants and the deserving and the undeserving. And again, a lot of that, if you really peeled it right back, and some of the people who have the views that we might not agree with wouldn't agree with what I'm about to say, which is, I think your position is coming from a place of fear. Of course they wouldn't recognise that. But that's what's happening. We're all fearful for our own security and survival, and sometimes that's when the hostility and hatred can come out. So the more we can do, I guess, you know, bringing it back to ourselves, the more we can do that for ourselves and just be compassionate about our fear when we're looking at our own behaviours, then the better chance we've got to become more compassionate and more ethical. You know, when you realise that sometimes you act in anger or unpleasantly because you're tired and fearful or stressed or X or Y, or you've had a year or a lifetime of being told X or Y, and you end up with a view of the world that's kind of, that's faulty thinking, then just feel compassion for the reasons, you know, the reasons behind that, and that will help you, you know, help us all to grow. Because, so moving on to sort of like, well, what motivates us to bother being ethical, and why have religions, including Buddhism, developed prescriptions for the good ethical life? Well, I think those who've gone before us, and, you know, the Buddha is kind of the epitome of it for us in Buddhism, have discovered that if you do focus on this part of your existence, then happiness and liberation and contentment will follow. I was thinking about it the other day and thinking, I used to think, and I think it's still true, that when I first came across Buddhism, and I was sort of resisting, there was lots of resistances going on, and I used to say, well, there's lots of good people in the world who are all really ethical and they're not Buddhists, so what's happening? So, you know, why do we all think that we're right because we're Buddhists and that they're not quite there yet? And of course, I don't think we do think that, but that's what I used to think at the time. And of course, some people are very naturally very, very kind and generous and all of the other qualities that make a good person. And I suppose the observation I was having for myself the other day thinking about this talk was like, and generally speaking, those people who are kind and compassionate and behave in an exemplary manner are usually quite happy and usually quite contented. So that's a result. So you can see that in their lives. And for me, I've certainly it certainly becomes clear the more you focus on how you're behaving towards yourself and towards others, is that the more positively and more skillfully you behave towards yourself and others, the more content and happy you become. So it feels quite selfish to dress it like that, but that's what motivates any of us to do anything. And ultimately, I think what also happens, which is where the kind of the title of this series around the natural path to insight or wisdom comes from, is that as part of studying the Dharma, meditating, being in Sangha together, ethics is a strong pillar of our three jewels. It also means that as you mature into being a more ethical person, your wisdom unfolds, your general, you know, it starts to become not something that you even think that you're practicing. It just becomes who you are, and that sense of wonder, and I hesitate to use the word enlightenment. I wouldn't know what that feels like. Maybe there's moments, but definitely a dropping away of all of the anxieties and superficialness that is in our thoughts mostly, so that you do see the world and everyone in it as a source of wonder and joy, just sort of pure joy. And I think that's why we, ultimately, that's why we're practicing ethics. But on a day-to-day basis, I practice ethics because it makes me feel better. It brings a relief to not go around getting things right all the time or being a good girl all the time, but noticing when I'm not and just admitting it and trying to look at why that happened and sort of, you know, again, going back to the only judge is your human heart, and not judging myself about it, but just owning it and going, okay, yeah, that happened. And that's where, when you're in the order, one of the things that you do regularly is meet with other friends in the order and do a confession practice, which is, if anyone's been involved in other religions, it's not a confession practice where somebody external is kind of forgiving you or giving you punishment or penance for that confession, but it's more that you're in a collective group of people who are all trying to do the same thing, and that you're putting it out there really in a very kind of special way amongst friends who love and care about you, who are not judging you, who are just going almost like, well done for saying that, well done for getting that off your chest, and also challenging you if that's a repetitive activity of like, and how can we help, you know, kind of start looking at how do you want to change, do you want to develop beyond this activity that's clearly bringing you distress. Because one of the reasons people confess in whatever religion, I think, is because it brings you distress to have acted in a way or thought in a way or spoken in a way that feels uncomfortable and unpleasant, and you want to just release yourself from that distress. And saying it out loud, often in a non-hostile environment, to at the very least, is often enough. Because I think often what I find is I do something that makes me feel a bit icky, and then I sort of double the pain by concealing it and going, oh, I can't possibly tell people I've done that thing or had that thought or said that thing. But actually, that's just sort of beating myself up even further about it. And if you just say it out loud, it kind of is quite cleansing and quite liberating. So, yeah. I was thinking as well, just looking around society about, and sort of skipping back, but I wanted to say these couple of things. So the other things that I've been noticing, as well as the refugee crisis, which is the big one, are two other things, is the Labour Party leadership contest. And I've just been on holiday to Croatia, and I've noticed the art of queuing, which is a very... breaks down by national boundaries, and I'll say more. So the Labour Party leadership. The thing I wanted to just say there was, there are people joining the Labour Party so that they can vote, who are Conservative Party supporters, so that they can mischievously vote for a candidate that they think will mean that the Labour Party, and I'm not sure that this is happening in huge numbers, but it's happening, so that they can mischievously vote for someone that might make the party that they don't like struggle to ever get into power again. Now, there's something unethical about that, to say the least. Mm-hmm. And someone said to me, oh, well, in some countries, like America and Australia, it's impossible to do that. There's, you know, rules and laws against it. And I said, there shouldn't have to be a law against it. It should... if those people were acting from a pure ethical basis, they just wouldn't do that, because it's just not the right thing to do. And I suppose, and many, many, many people wouldn't do that because they know it's just not the right thing to do. It doesn't, and that's where I just thought it was an interesting example. You agree or disagree, that's, you know, by the by, really, that, you know, we innately know the right thing to do, and most people do it. And it's really noticeable when it's not done. And that's why I think, and of course, society brings in laws and rules that are punishable by loss of liberty, because they feel that we don't always all do the right thing. But underneath it all, it is completely possible for us to do the right thing most of the time. And the other thing that I was noticing was queuing. Why do we queue? And I was watching it in a TV programme, actually, about being British, and sort of this like a comedy, kind of people just talking heads about all the funny things about being British, and obviously queuing is one of the things we do. But the Germans queue as well. And when I was in holiday in Croatia, the Germans at my hotel queued every morning at 8 o'clock outside the swimming pool gates for the swimming pool gates to open so that they could put their towels down. But at least they were queuing. And you know, and someone was sort of saying on in this TV programme that queuing's about being fair. You know, and being fair is being ethical. It's kind of like, so we manifest these things in the ways we behave together, you know. And of course, and you know, we British love a queue, you know, and we get very shirty if someone tries to subvert a queue, and we all, you know, so like ethical activities happening all over the place. Of course, I could talk for hours about the sunbeds and the towels, but I'm not going to. The fact that they never turn up then till midday to lie on those sunbeds is another point for another talk of the day. But I just thought it was an amusing example of fairness manifesting itself in community behaviour. So talking a little bit then about Buddhist ethics in particular. One of the things that I think it's really important to say about any Buddhist teachings, and it no doubt will have been said time and time again, is that what the Buddha said all over the sutras and the texts that remain with us today is that whatever it is I'm saying to you, judge it, test it in your own experience, and if you find it brings you benefit, then do it. And I think that's absolutely the case with the way that the way that ethics is set out in Buddhist teachings, is that these are up, you know, these are written down as in a particular way with particular topics and themes in order to help us consider the possibility that behaving or acting in these ways will be helpful. And if we don't find it helpful, then clearly it won't be some higher power or some external hierarchical force that's going to tell us we must do these things in order for us to do them. And that's what's precious about Buddhism, and one of the things I think is central to my admiration of the Buddha and all that have come before since then. That's not to say that I don't have a huge amount of time for lovely people operating in other religious faiths. I was having dinner with a friend of mine a couple of weeks ago who was a Church of England vicar, and we were having a conversation about ethics, and you know, underneath everything, she imbues it, she does it every day, and she's trying to live her life the best she can, and she's doing it for good motivations, and not because someone's told her to, but because she deeply believes it all in her heart. And I think that's very true of millions of people in different religions. But I think that the core thing to remember with the Buddhist teachings on ethics is, as I said at the beginning, the person or the thing or the sense you need to be listening to is how it's affecting your heart and what your heart is telling you to do, because our minds are monkeys and our minds will have all sorts of thoughts and ideas that are unpleasant and unhelpful, and our heart will tell us what to do with those thoughts, and I think it can be a good judge. So We're going to be looking at 10 precepts over the coming weeks. Now, these 10 precepts are an exploration of the central five precepts that many of us are chanting when we come here on a Saturday, and are traditional in all Buddhist communities all over the world. And one of the things I always like to remember when I'm doing the refuges and precepts is the fact that probably millions of people, and right now probably somewhere thousands of people, are actually chanting those very precepts and those refuges. And there's something, you know, just incredibly sort of grounding about that. The 10 precepts have got a very long route back into history as well. And there's a particular, I'll talk about some of the books that are around later, but there's a particular book called The Ten Pillars, which is one of Sangharakshita's earlier works. Well, not actually, not early. And he talks about some of the canonical references to the 10 precepts. The one that stands out for me is, I think it's quite interesting, is that it comes up in a story about a king who was wanting some advice about how to do a sacrificial ceremony which was going to involve the killing of thousands of animals, which always seems like such a bizarre thing, but there we are. And the character in the story, who's kind of like allegedly a sort of legendary kind of he's the Buddha in disguise in a way in this sort of story, says, well, never mind killing all these animals, how about sacrificing your kind of yourselves and your unskillful behaviours and doing it in this way. And he sets out sort of 10 areas of unskillfulness that could be let go of, could be sacrificed instead of these animals. And pretty clever and beautiful way to get that message across, and how it's not about doing it with a bunch of innocent beings, but doing it through, you know, sacrificing the badness or the unethical behaviour on your own heart to celebrate that event. So, and that's the way it's set out. It's set out in sort of twin goals, things that we'd like to do less of and things that we'd like to cultivate. And that idea of skillful and unskillful, I think, is a much more useful way to consider our behaviour and our actions than good and bad. Because going back to what I was saying before about fear and compassion, if you really understand yourself and understand others, then it is not about being evil or being nasty. It's about just being misguided and unskillful. And that's not lessening some of the terrible things that happen, but that, you know, the more terrible they are, the more deeply that unskillfulness is manifested from some deep, 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 deep fear that's kind of sitting behind that. So, I wonder if I might just say all of the precepts, you know, out loud, just to kind of give you a sense of them. And they're broken into sort of three areas, really. And again, it comes back to a sort of central Buddhist idea of body, speech, and mind. And the precepts kind of cover those three areas. So I'm going to say the sort of the negative, or the thing to try and eradicate, and the thing to cultivate. So it's kind of the positive and negative and positive. I don't like this translation, I've just realised. It's falling apart. So, I undertake to abstain from taking life. With deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body. I undertake to abstain from taking the not given. With open-handed generosity, I purify my body. I undertake to abstain from sexual misconduct. With stillness, simplicity, and contentment, I purify my body. I undertake to abstain from false speech. With truthful communication, I purify my speech. I undertake to abstain from harsh speech. With words kindly and gracious, I purify my speech. I undertake to abstain from useless speech. With utterance helpful and harmonious, I purify my speech. I undertake to abstain from slanderous speech. With utterance helpful and harmonious, I purify my speech. I undertake to abstain from covetousness. Abandoning covetousness for tranquility, I purify my mind. I undertake to abstain from animosity. Changing hatred into compassion. I purify my mind. I undertake to abstain from false views. Transforming ignorance into wisdom, I purify my mind. So there's a lifetime's work inside those, and certainly a few months of explorations for us. So I don't think I can really do justice to any of them by talking about them in very much detail. But I think it's interesting that one of the transitions from the five precepts, which we all take on is in a commitment way when we become mitras, to the 10 precepts that you take on when you get ordained, is where the extension happens. And for someone who can talk for Britain, the extension around the speech precepts is particularly, you know, I think it's fascinating. It was quite a relief as well, because as with many of us, it's around, we can have our thoughts and they can sometimes be a bit unpleasant and unhelpful, but it's when you say things out loud that are unpleasant or unhelpful or unskillful that you affect other people and affect yourself when you go, oh, we haven't said that. That where I can still quite easily beat myself up about how unskillful my speech can be in moments of stress, tiredness or anger. But of course, the Buddha, so the relief is the Buddha recognised that so much that there are four precepts about speech. So I thought, phew, it's not just me then. It's not just me then, and there's four very specific identifiable things that are different elements that are useful to consider when you're going about your day-to-day life. So it's not as straightforward as telling the truth. It's not being harsh. You can tell the truth in a kind way, or you can tell the truth in a harsh way. So even if you're speaking the truth and not lying, you can still be acting unskillfully because you're being quite brusque about it. And frivolous speech, well, it's quite delightful, really, that people have frivolous speech in the time of the Buddha? You know, it often feels like it's something that we've just cultivated beautifully, certainly in the 20th, 21st century. There's so much to have trivial and frivolous speech about, from Kim Kardashian to whatever. And the fact that I know who she is a bit... bit of a confession. Anyway, and then the slanderous speech, you know, and so there's so many elements to this, to how we manifest ourselves in the world and the way we're speaking to people, that there's plenty to do there. And I think it is because it's how we appear in the world is often seen through the way we speak and the way we converse with people, that or the things that we don't say as much as the things we do say. You know, how liberating is it certainly for me to have the courage sometimes to say sorry out loud to someone when I've been a bit harsh or a bit inconsiderate in my speech towards them. So sometimes it's about speaking out at the right time, and or saying the thank you, or remembering to make a positive contribution to someone's day by telling them that they've just done something amazing, or that you're really grateful for the thing that they did. Really appreciate them. You know, again, I think, so I guess that, you know, that's a suggestion to all of us, but perhaps particularly to people who are shyer, who might not think that they've got anything to say. We've all got something to say, and everyone really appreciates it. I've noticed lately that I've started trying, particularly in London, to kind of just smile and say hello to people as you walk down the street, because it's just not really done. And it's just really surprising and lovely that, well, it's never had a negative effect. I've never had a scowl back. I've usually had a hello and at least a nod, if it's not of surprise. But, you know, imagine if we all started doing that in London. It'd be a bit terrifying, but it could be lovely. Because I've lived in really small towns and villages, and people wouldn't dream of passing someone on the street without speaking to them. You know, human being coming, hello, human being's gone. It doesn't happen in Wentworth Road in West Croydon unless I make it happen. So there's lots of skillful activity we can start throwing at the world all the time if we just put our minds to it, even if it's just a smile. So in a way, I think it's probably, you know, what would be, you know, what's a useful place to start when you're looking at ethical behaviour is not what am I getting wrong, inverted commas, but what can I do more of that's lovely? You know, so look at the positive side of the precepts as a form of practice. Because I guess the more you fill your life with doing positive things and saying nice things and remembering to thank people and, you know, just taking that, if you have that thought of generosity, just actually taking that step and doing that thing, then the less room there will be for unskillful behaviour. So you'll swing that pendulum away from your fear and towards your compassion. And it will bring good to others and to you, because, as I said before, there's definitely a natural thing, I think, that we all experience, that the more appreciative we are, the more consciously we bring ourselves into the world in a skillful way, the benefits just come flooding back at us. You know, I think that's, otherwise if they didn't, we probably would, there'd be no motivation to do that. And it's not that, you know, it's not about being goody-two-shoes. That's not coming from a place of compassion. That's coming from a place of wanting to be seen to be right and seen to be doing good. And I don't think that's what the Buddha is teaching us. I don't think that's what religions are teaching us about being ethical. It's just about, it's the contented and open-hearted way of being, if we can. And, you know, if there's, and there will be days and moments when we're feeling grumpy and sad or tired or unhappy, and just accepting that as well, you know, and not, but then I suppose then watching out for the negativity. Sometimes we actually notice that, oh, I'm a bit grumpy, aren't I, when we speak out in some situation where we're suddenly a bit sharp with the cashier or the man in the train station. So in a way, the more we notice our unskillful behaviour when it happens, it helps us, you know, if we really look at it and go, whoa, what's happening here? Oh, yeah, I'm having a bit of a bad day here. What's going on? And turn that over a bit and try and look with kindness at what's behind what we just did or what we... And it might not happen in that moment. It might be hours later. But the more awareness we can bring to just how we're being in the world, I think, whether it's to help us unfold and discover and have... bring compassion to the anxieties and unhappinesses that we've got in our life that we want to try and work on, or whether it's just trying to reach out to people to grow their happiness and ours as being all members of this human society together, then all of that is going to have a collective benefit for our behaviour. I guess the key behind all of that is to just grow our awareness and not walk around in our lives in a fog of sleepy, self-interested behaviour that isn't bearing in mind anybody else around us. So, you know, ethics is not a solo activity. It's an activity that by its very nature is having an effect, for good or not, towards everything and everyone around us. And that's not just human beings. You know, the first precept in both this is about the very direct act of not harming other things, living beings, whether it's the tiniest to the biggest, and the planet, you know, comes inside all of that as well. So I think that's probably kind of a bit of a romp around the things I wanted to say. I would just mention a few books that are available in a bookshop close by, that you might be interested in having a look at over the coming weeks. One that's just been pointed out to me. This is a lovely book, which even the title makes me want to read it, which is written by one of our order members from London, from East London, and it's a very beautifully put together book that's also got lots of exercises and reflections that you can do. So that's very practical and very beautifully crafted. It's called Not About Being Good by Subhadra Mati, A Practical Guide to Buddhist Ethics. And that's been out about a year or so now. It's quite a new one. And then, of course, there's Sangharakshita's 10 Pillars, which is a very interesting sort of exposition of why he chose these particular 10 precepts that I've just outlined to you for his order, and what they are, and goes into them in good detail. And then the sort of general kind of area of metta and kindness, which is really the kind of basis of all ethical practice. There's always Living with Kindness, also by Sangharakshita. And Nigel's just recommended Mind in Harmony, which is one of Subhuti's books, which, again, I mean, he's an incredible thinker and is very good on the kind of psychological sort of basis behind ethics as well, that whole thing around our thinking and where does our thinking come from and what to do about it. We don't have to be our thoughts, but our thoughts come up. And I think that's it. So that's probably for the more cerebral amongst us, but it's also quite accessible, depending on where you go.
It was recommended by Dhamma Vijaya, actually.
Ah, okay.
And
yeah.
He said it was a very good insight.
So, I mean, Subhuti is a very articulate man on the Dharma, so anything by him is always worth exploring. So I think that's probably me. Has anyone got any questions?
Just a comment,
yeah.
It's about the unsaid. I had got a letter from it's Gabriel Garcia Marquez, probably one of South America's greatest writers of last century. And when he was dying, of course he came to, now he'd expressed himself through many, many books throughout his life, and yet when he was dying of lymph cancer, he wrote a letter, which actually has been since circulated on the internet. Unfortunately, it was in Spanish, so I had to get some sort of translator to get it into English. But really, when you looked at it, what he was really saying is, don't die with all of those things you'd have loved to have said to people unsaid. You know, yes, we say horrible things to people, but there's lots of nice things that we would like to say to people, which we don't say. Mm. We keep it to ourselves. Mm. And he said, don't die leaving those unsaid.
Yeah. I'd like to make a comment about cues.
Oh, here we go.
Well, I have to confess, I got a towel down myself years ago on the beach.
I did it every morning.
Yeah. Now, about queues, the British don't always queue. You just try and get on the bus in Brixton. So people don't queue there.
Right, Dan?
Excellent. Well, may I was just saying before to Dipakshini that it'd be nice to when we have the time when we come to the end of our mornings on a Saturday to maybe just have another little sit for 5-10 minutes and possibly chant something, just to sort of round off our morning. And with that in mind as well, I just like to make a request that when we get to the end of our Saturday mornings, however we end them, to try and sort of leave the shrine room quietly and just and sort of hold that precious space that we've had together and have our conversations back in the world, which is just out there, because everyone's in probably different places and spaces in here, and the Buddha's here, so just kind of keeping the place a bit more sacred sometimes, and rushing off into our thoughts and minds of the rest of the day. So